Stella, yes. What did I have for breakfast? Well, I tell you, I had a plate similar to the one you just saw. Mostly berries of various kinds, grapefruit, bit of kiwi fruit. Pretty much that plate. That's what I had for breakfast. That's not what you have to have for breakfast.
Not the mushroom.
No, the earlier slide. Let's see if I can find it. That one. That's the kind of thing. That's the kind of thing I tend to have for breakfast mostly. Tea. I was just, yeah, the lady. It's a very good, I mean, the question of allergies is a very thorny question. The best thing is not to have them in the first place. I mean, that sounds a little Irish. Allergies tend to come around when you're babies and you've fed foods which the baby can't handle. And in particular, it's an interesting question. For example, the sand bushmen would be feeding their small children that were being weaned, they'd feed them on raw eggs. That's the kind of thing they could chew even if they didn't have any teeth. They'd feed them on brains and stuff like that too. And that seemed to work okay. It seems to be that when it comes to allergies, one potentiates the other, or one allergen potentiates the other. So you sometimes have babies that have been, particularly if they've been fed on some kind of formula milk, which might have soy in it, and they have egg, then that triggers an egg allergy, which you shouldn't normally be having. And when you've educated the immune system to react in this kind of way, it's very hard to uneducate it again. We've had people who've, my wife's a classic case. She had terrible allergies. She went cold turkey on the sort of thing I've been talking about and almost got rid of everything except this terrible feeling of sand in her eyes. And I said to her, look, you're just going to have to give up that one slice of bread you have every day. No, I'm not. No, I'm not. And said, yeah, I said, that's it. Just try it for a month. She tried it for a month and then finally it went. Now, I'm not saying that this is going to happen to everybody, but, and I think you're in the health profession too, you'll know that when people have allergies, what you try and do is have an elimination diet. You start them off on virtually nothing and gradually add things back until you find what it is that they're allergic to. And of course, you give them skin tests and all that kind of thing. It's a tricky thing. Because you never quite know what it is that's going to do it, because often it's several things happening at once and it's the last one that gets the blame, whereas it's probably a number of other things happening too. So I mean, the bottom line is really yes, you really do try and go cold turkey on what I'm talking about and see what happens, and maybe you have to eliminate something like eggs, maybe it's something you never get rid of. It's just possible. Yeah.
Any more questions? Sorry, I just wanted to ask you, there's been a lot of research lately about fructose
Yeah.
and the fructose pathway, even eating too much fruit.
Yeah.
And
So the question is, what about fructose? Yeah, I talk about it, of course, in my book. Fructose is sometimes thought of as being the good guy of all the sugars because it doesn't have a glycemic reaction and it causes blood sugars peak. And of course, fructose is present in the savanna environment, but in much smaller quantities than is the case in modern foodstuffs. I mean, the fruits that are talked about are very, apples, for example, are very rich in fructose. And in larger quantities, it's a problem to the human biochemistry. So sometimes people think, oh, I can replace sugar by fructose. I can put it in my tea. I can use it, to sweeten my cakes and everything. Well, you can't use it ad libitum. You have to be cautious with it. It upsets fatty acid profiles in the blood, cholesterol levels, does all kinds of funny things. It upsets the intestinal system. So yeah, fructose is not the magic answer to sweeteners. It's normal to be having a little bit, but it's not normal to be having lots.
Even overeating too much fruit, I don't think.
Even overeating too much fruit can do it, yeah. Oh yeah, if you eat that plate in one go, I mean, I make that stretch out the whole morning. And if I'm going out, oh yeah, no, I should have made that clear. And if I'm going out, I take a little plastic bag, put what's left, take it with me, and I eat bits and pieces of it as I go around. Oh no, I wouldn't. You wouldn't want to eat all that in one go. Too much sugar. Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it's these milks are for the actually have fairly similar profiles, and even human milk has a similar kind of profile to cow's milk. I mean, they certainly have differences. I mean, human milk is designed to build bigger brains, and not particularly to build horns. But ultimately, it's all the same problem, that it's not designed for people to consume once they've got beyond the age of about 4 or 5 years old. Yeah, so any kind of milk, it doesn't matter if it's sheep's milk, goat's milk, whatever.
Can you say some more about acid alkaline balance?
Ah.
It's something that isn't recognized when they look at diet and change of lifestyle, you find it ever been dismissed, and it's so important.
Exactly. I alluded to the idea of acid alkali consumption, or at least the fact that plant food that our bodies were designed to work with would be alkali forming in the body. When we look at that savanna scene out there, we saw a lion killing a zebra. Now, a zebra would be eating a rather alkalizing diet. That is to say, what he was eating, by the time it got into his body fluids, would tend to alkalize those body fluids. The lion, on the other hand, is a carnivore. He eats other animals, eat meat. And meat is has an acidifying effect on the body. Now, a lion's biochemistry is designed to work that way. A zebra's body is designed to work the way it does. It turns out that human beings are designed to work on a pretty neutral kind of intake. That is to say, the acid intake balances the alkalizing intake. And that's where this ratio of 75% plant food to 25% animal matter comes in. And this 75% of plant food is the alkalizing type of plant food. And one thing I didn't mention that is wrong with grains and wrong with potato is that it's also acidifying. So you're also acidifying your body by consuming grains and potato instead of alkalizing it by eating the other kinds of plant food, which is the right kind of food for us. Now, what are the consequences of having ultimately what amounts to an acidic diet? Most people in the West are eating what amounts to an acidifying diet. It attacks various parts of the body. It attacks the pancreas, it attacks the thyroid, it upsets the lymphatic system. A whole range of issues come from eating an acidifying diet. And of course, it drags calcium out of the bones, part of the syndrome leading to osteoporosis. So, yes, it's something that isn't talked about a lot, but the idea that we should be eating a diet which is broadly neutral, neither too acidic nor too alkalizing, is the way for human beings. And when I talk about eating the way I do, it comes out just fine. You don't have to calculate it, it works out just fine.
And you feel much better.
And you feel much better for it, yes.
I want to ask Ken about supplements. And following on to Sarah's question about soil depletion, which is really well studied, especially in the United States, that soil depletes of nutrients. In addition to that, there is also this problem of green harvesting of food. And then there is a problem of the time interval between harvesting and the consumer, when the consumer gets it. And all this points towards taking supplements, really just like I do. Yeah.
You know,
we can't escape
the question. You know, the question is soil depletion, and in particular fruits which are picked green and then transported thousands of miles and allowed to ripen later, and so on. Is this the right kind of foodstuffs? Well, of course, it's not ideal. You're right. Much better if you can eat fruits that are picked straight off the tree and they're ripened.
Ethiopia.
You're from Ethiopia. Yeah, it's absolutely wonderful. And unless we've still got that in Cyprus, for example, where I spend, where I live most of the time, at least it's my base. And, you know, you've still got, in the supermarkets, the peasants come in and they've just collected the apricots as they fall off the trees. And that's wonderful. And you know the difference. Of course it is. But I still like to give it, put it in, give it this priority, prioritize things. Of course, it would be better to have fruits that are plucked straight off the tree ripe. And it would be better to have vegetables that have been grown in rich soils that have that give a, and the reality is the vegetable can't grow properly unless it is properly nourished. So it has got to have something. And so that, so the point is you've got to be eating it and not eating the rice and the grains and all that, and not eating for all the good reasons I've just been talking about. And the fact, just the simple fact of substituting even an unripe banana for the grains is already a great step in the right direction. Huge step in the right direction. Now, when it comes to supplements, what are you going to take? I mean, God Almighty, there's tens of thousands of micronutrients that our body needs. You're going to take vitamin C, you're going to take vitamin D, you're going to take this, you're going to take that, and wait a minute, am I taking too much zinc now? I mean, it's only in the last few years that the health authorities, who for a long time have been recommending minimum intakes of certain kinds of vitamins, are suddenly realizing there's maximums they ought to be imposing too. So people are overdosing on these things. And overdosing on many of these things also is very harmful. How do you micromanage that? My argument is that you don't need to micromanage it. You actually just eat the way the body expects. And the proof of the pudding really is in the eating. That actually, if you eat, it's funny how we're talking about food all the time, but rather than the physical activity, but or stress and what have you. The reality is that if you do adopt this pattern and get the big picture right, then the little picture kind of sorts itself out. Well, what do you think that San Bushman was doing? Was he eating dairy products? Was he taking supplements? Of course not. You don't need it. I mean, it's one of the biggest myths out there, the biggest urban myths out there, promoted by the dairy industry, that you've got to be drinking milk by the bucketful to get your calcium. It's nonsense. You don't talk to qualified nutritionists. They have a dogma. Why is it that the hospitals in America pay good money to bring me all the way from Cyprus to America to speak to their medical staff in their teaching hospitals when they've got nutritionists on the staff? It's because they know that nutritionists haven't got the answer. They have to, a nutritionist to be qualified, and I'm sure we've got some nutritionists here, knows that they have to follow protocols. And if they don't, even if they agree with what I have to say, they can't actually say it. And
are you saying that the recommended daily intake of calcium is too high, or are you saying you can get that
Well, I'm saying that, of course, calcium is in a great deal of plant food, particularly the kind of plant food I'm talking about. It's not so much in the grains, of course, or in the potatoes, but it is in the kind of plant food I'm talking about. Yeah, it's in the broccoli, it's in the Brussels sprouts and so on. But the myth is that you need to be having such large quantities. People think that they're getting osteoporosis because bones are made of calcium phosphate, and we've got to be stuffing calcium into them to stop them crumbling. No, bone health is all to do with a whole range of other things which have almost nothing to do with whether or not you're taking in calcium.
So how come calcium and vitamin D supplements?
Well, you put your finger on vitamin D, haven't you?
Yeah,
absolutely. It's not the calcium, it's the vitamin D. People are suffering terrible deficiencies of vitamin D, and that is one of the factors of many which are important to ensure that bones do, in fact, get built properly. Because your bones are constantly being deconstructed and reconstructed. It's going on the whole time. We replace our skeletons three times in a lifetime. And this process is easily I just came here to talk about cancer, but I'll talk about bone health if you like. there are a number of things. I mean, bone health, what is it? We've got these osteoclasts climbing all around our bones like painters, paint strippers going over the Eiffel Tower, stripping the paint off, stripping our bones down, and then behind them come the osteoblasts, putting bone back, a bit like painters, coming putting the paint back on the lattices of the Eiffel Tower. Now, this is a carefully orchestrated procedure. Those osteoclasts are talking to the osteoblasts, they're talking to the colon, and the osteoblasts are talking to the colon, saying, hey, if you see a calcium molecule passing by, pop it in the bloodstream, I need to pick it up and put it into this particular place. All this signaling is going on in all kinds of ways. And the problem with bone health is that we interrupt that signaling in all kinds of ways. And the ways are manifold. I mean, for example, astronauts, they lose 5% of their bone mass for every month in space. Doesn't matter how much calcium or vitamin D they take. Why? Mainly because they're weightless. Part of a healthy lifestyle is actually moving around and stressing your bones. That's what triggers the signals to build bone. And same thing, of course, with bedridden people. They're more likely to lose bone mass. Another issue is to do with, for example, high phosphoric acid intake. High phosphorus intake tends to depress the parathyroid, which is responsible for, amongst other things, sending out hormones which talk to the osteoblasts and osteoclasts. Why do people all of a sudden have so much phosphorus in their bloodstreams? They're drinking Coca-Cola. Now, when we were kids, Coca-Cola, you had that 6.5-ounce bottle, you had it once a week. Now, people drink it by the gallon every day. Suddenly, we flipped from one thing to the other. That is undermining our bone health. There's a whole range of issues to do with that. Sunshine, of course, absolutely. Vitamin D. So the whole range. And micronutrients, yes, it's there, right there in the literature. People who eat plenty of micronutrients in the form of plant food have stronger bones than those who don't. It's right there. People who eat an alkalizing diet, much more likely to have healthy bones than those who eat an acidic diet. It's right there in the literature. So, and for example, take the Eskimo. The Eskimo, he lives a life where he's almost entirely carnivorous. He's eating seal, he's eating whale, he's eating caribou, for example, and other creatures. Now, the Eskimo has terrible bone health. He doesn't get the sunshine, and he's eating a terribly acidifying diet. They have terrible osteoporosis. They actually benefit from other side of things. For example, they don't get multiple sclerosis so much. They don't get cancers so much. But they have terrible bones, and it's mainly because of a highly acidifying diet they're eating. So this is all part of the picture. This goes back to the acid-alkali balance we were talking about a little earlier. So there's a whole range of issues where we're undermining our bone health through a number of factors all adding themselves up, of which calcium intake is a really minor part, because you can take all the calcium you want. If the signal doesn't go to the colon to pop it into the bloodstream, it doesn't actually get absorbed. Okay, any other questions?
Three Your Trust newsletter, you quoted as saying that we don't agree that we need 2 liters of water a day, which is what the medical record says. And there's also apart from Coca-Cola, what else do you want?
We're talking about fluids. Now, I do think that, now there's one great myth that's come about, and that is we should all be drinking 8 glasses of water a day. It came about, it was really quite extraordinary, it came about through the American Institute, it's the Institute of Medicine, came out with the recommendation that the total intake of water should be about what amounts to 8 glasses of water a day. But that's including what water is actually in the food you're eating. So when you actually boil it down to liquids, then it's rather less, a lot less. In fact, we're talking about, hey, why are we forcing water into ourselves when we don't feel thirsty? Why do we have a thirst reflex? Well, if we're living healthily, we'll have a healthy thirst reflex. And that's Sam Bushman, for example. He wasn't drinking a lot. There's a kidney specialist, Valtin, who is really very vehement about this whole business of drinking water, you know, vast quantities of water that actually we don't need, and is really much promoted by Perrier. It's Perrier who started it, this 8 glasses of water. They picked up on this. back in the 80s now. And that was when it first got started. And so now everybody was walking around with bottles of water all the time. I argue that yes, of course you need to drink fluids. And if you're living in a hot place and you sweat a lot, you need to drink more. If you just had a game of squash, you need a drink, of course. Tempting to drink a pint of beer, but probably not such a good idea. But yeah, we don't need as much as we have been told just in recent times. Nobody, you know, up until about 30 years ago, nobody thought twice about whether or not they were drinking enough water. And ultimately, this idea that we're dehydrating is actually a myth too. I mean, people can dehydrate if they're old and they've got all sorts of problems and their thirst reflex isn't working properly, or for some reason or another they can't drink properly. Of course, that is medically possible. But if you're an ordinary, healthy human being, fully functioning, work with your thirst reflex. Drink what you, you know, drink when you feel you really need it. And water, of course, is the ideal thing. You know, I talked about tea. Well, you know, yeah, tea, herbal teas. These are all things. Even coffee's okay. And the thing to, and if you like, of course, if you're talking about satiating thirst, you wouldn't be drinking alcohols particularly, but you know, dry wines are okay. I talked about beer. Well, the problem with beer is it's highly glycemic, so that's why we don't drink beer very much. It's a great shame. Otherwise, that's it. Yeah. Well, shall we just take two more and then we'll take two more and that's it. Okay. All right.
Your main carbohydrates come from then?
Well, it comes... Now, it's a good question. Carbohydrate. What do you call a carbohydrate?
Bread, grains, rice.
You're talking about starches.
Starches.
Are only one kind of carbohydrate. You see, green beans, broccoli, they're carbohydrates, aren't they? Lettuce is carbohydrate too. They're what we call the ultra-slow carbohydrates. Those are the carbohydrates that our bodies are designed to work on, because it does indeed turn them ultimately into sugar. But that terrible, of course, there's very little of it, and it does it very slowly, which is the way the body expects it to be. It doesn't need or want, in fact, it is thoroughly stressed out when you start putting in what is commonly called carbohydrates, the starches in particular. Yeah. So.
You need to consume
20 pounds of veggies. Well, yeah, but why would you be eating potato? You know, why are you comparing it with potato? You should be, if you're thinking about eating potato, you say, what amount of potato corresponds to eating that big salad I showed? Well, don't eat the potato. Okay.
One research program years ago I heard, they showed that by pasteurizing milk, you changed the calcium form into a form that the body actually couldn't metabolize.
Well, this is another good question. Yeah, it's the treating that milk goes through now, pasteurizing, you're saying, and certainly the homogenizing, converts the or makes the cal make. Puts the calcium into a form it can't absorb very easily, and indeed the calcium in cheese is almost not absorbed at all. It kind of chemically combines with some of the fats that are in cheese, and it just goes straight through the body and out the other end. So eating cheese for its calcium is a total waste of time, and seemingly milk too. Is the way it's treated today means that it actually makes the calcium non-available. Yeah. Okay, thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
On behalf of the Speedwell Trust, I'd like to thank you very much for this most enlightening talk. And like you said, you threw your wife a lifeline. I think you have thrown a lot of people here a lifeline if they appreciate what you've said, and I certainly do. And it's just so rewarding to hear it said in such an articulate way. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you. Thank you. I'll be signing copies of my book at the end if you're interested.
Have you got a photograph you can send me, or shall I take one now?
Oh, well, take one now if you like, and we'll see what... We'll...